So at this point, it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker for today, Paul Davidovits. As many of you know, he's a professor of chemistry here at Boston College, where he's taught for nearly 35 years now. He's the author of numerous scholarly publications in his field, and for the past 15 years or so, he and his students at BC have produced important research on the physical chemistry of gas-liquid interactions at the interface, including an understanding of how gas molecules enter liquids and how they react at gas-liquid interface. The work has provided key parameters needed to understand the role of cloud and aerosol chemistry and atmospheric processes such as acid rain formation, dry acid deposition, and ozone depletion. Just pronouncing these is hard enough for me, so I apologize if I'm off track here. Recently, he and his collaborators have developed a novel aerosol mass spectrometer for field and laboratory aerosol studies. This apparatus is yielding new information about the morphology-dependent chemistry of atmospheric aerosols. His PhD is from Columbia University. Today he will not be speaking about aerosol chemistry, or at least not at length, but rather about the relationship between scientific knowledge and faith as part of the Boisy Center's ongoing series of lunch colloquia on the theme of ways of knowing and the Catholic intellectual traditions. Paul, we're delighted to have you here.
Well, thank you, Eric, and thank you for the opportunity to present this topic, scientific knowledge and faith. As far as I know, this topic doesn't fall into any sort of organized subject. So it was a lot of fun to try to set a framework within which we could discuss this, and I hope that the framework I have chosen makes sense, but I'm sure you'll tell me. But at least I know that my colleague here will tell me if it makes sense. He usually does that. Well, to start with, I guess we have to define the notion of scientific knowledge and the notion of faith. Usually when we think of faith, we think of religious faith. But I have used a definition which is broader and includes it. Faith is a firm belief in something for which there is no proof. Now, faith is used very broadly and in many contexts, and of course always the problem is that it can be used so broadly that it loses meaning and loses principally numinosity. And here is one quote from New York Times, March 1, this year, buying stocks in a market like this takes a healthy dose of faith. This is not the kind of faith I am envisioning, although perhaps that is really maybe a more profound type. At any rate, faith seems to be a basic human trait, and it is in essence, I think, optimistic. We don't usually say, I hope the mice will chew up the wires in my house. We usually say, I hope my house will be protected from mice. In other words, there is an optimism involved. And what I would like to end up with, sort of, is to show you that science, at the forefront of its activity, is essentially faith-based. And that's sort of where we're going. Well, first I'd like to just talk about science. I want to point out that all scientific knowledge is empirical. It is based on observation, based on experiments. All of it, without any exception. And so we make observations and then we form a hypothesis. And then we test the hypothesis. And if it withstands the testing in the domain in which the experiments were conducted, then the attempt is to fit it into a broader theory. These are generalities, and I hope to give examples of this. Now, the other important thing to understand is that a hypothesis or a theory, which is sort of a broader ranging hypothesis, is only applicable in a domain where the experiments and observations were performed. It doesn't extend outside of it. So Ohm's law, very old example. Incidentally, Ohm's law. Law, the way we would not use the term laws anymore. In the 20th century, science stopped giving names as laws. They were not theories, principles, hypotheses, but laws were still from the 1800s. And Ohm's law, you may have studied it in basic physics in high school or whatever, it just says that the current through a wire is increases as the voltage increases. And this holds over a wide range, but then, for example, in 1920s, as the temperatures were, lower temperatures were obtainable, the experiments were extended beyond where Ohm's did his experiments, and it was shown that we have such things as superconductors, which don't obey Ohm's law. So that's simply an example where you have to stay within the context. The theory that we form must be predictive, testable, and any contradiction to it in the domain of its assumed applicability invalidates the theory. So here is a quote from Thomas Huxley, who was quite a prominent scientist. He said, "The great tragedy of science is the slaying of a beautiful hypothesis by an ugly fact." Or ugly facts. As an example of a scientific enterprise, I'd bring it to you Emily du Châtelet, a brilliant scientist, very little known, 1700s. She was married to a nobleman, a rich woman. She had two children, and then, which as was not unusual in those days, they agreed to go their separate ways. They did not get divorced. Divorce was not acceptable, but they did their own thing. Emily du Châtelet hired tutors and learned all the science really that was known in her day. She translated Newton's Principia, but not only did she translate them, she wrote commentaries and made it accessible to the French scientific community. She also did experiments. She dropped balls into sandbox and measured the depth to which the balls, the hole they made. And she showed that the kinetic energy, the depth to which the ball penetrated, was proportional to the velocity squared, not to the velocity as Newton had proposed. And she tested over a wide variety of object sizes and materials and so on. And this became a hypothesis. And later on, it became part of a broader theory called the kinetic theory. Just to continue with her life, she had four lovers. One of them was Voltaire. And at the age of 43, she became pregnant. And she knew that at that time, in her day, being pregnant at that age, it was very likely that she would die. So throughout her pregnancy, she worked feverishly on completing comments on the Principia, and then she died at the age of 43 in childbirth. So that's Emily du Châtelet. Now, what is the relationship between faith and science? This was one of your questions. For the purpose of our discussion, I would like to categorize faith into three classes. Faith that contradicts science. Faith that is tangential to science, that is, it does not interact with science. It's not testable by the methods of science. And the third is the faith that drives science. That's where we were. Okay, as you walk along Beacon Street, you come across St. Jude's Gate, and there you will see a quote from Luke, "For nothing is impossible with God." Well, you can obviously give much and deep and profound and wide-ranging meanings to this quote, but one of the possible interpretation is that miracles are possible. And at least all religions I know report miraculous events that contradict solidly established scientific principles. Splitting of the Red Sea, stopping of the sun. So a faith that leads a person to believe in such miracles is in contradiction to science. But I would like to point out, and this was one of your questions, Susan, there are many superb scientists that I know that have great faith in precisely these type of miracles. Miracles as described in the Bible or other holy documents. And they do excellent science, but they keep the two separate. These are fenced off. And this is a cartoon I like. Two scientists and one says to the other, and you can read it, I think you should be more explicit. So, this is where the thing, the miracles, that those, that kind of faith does not mix with science. Type 2 faith. This is tangential to science. Now, generally, this type of faith, the constructs centered around this type of faith, pose the big questions. Is there a meaning to life? Is there a guiding cosmic purpose? These are questions are not in the domain of science. They are in the domain of certain aspects of religion. And this type of faith is associated usually with constructs that are designed to reconcile or merge science with religion. And there's some beautiful construct, and one of them is that of Pierre Teilhard. He didn't use the Chardin with his name. It's just he wanted to be known as Pierre Teilhard. Most of you may have heard of him. He was a Jesuit and an accomplished scientist, but principally a geologist, paleontologist. Much of his work was done in China. And what he wanted to do is integrate faith and evolution. He believed there is a purpose to evolution. And this is more or less a quote from him, from one of his statements. An ever-increasing complexity, that is the purpose of evolution, an ever-increasing complexity ascending towards increasing consciousness and unification, drawn towards the supreme consciousness. He called it the Omega point, which for him was God. Incidentally, there are a lot of people who sort of are very taken by his construct and his faith in this. And they see, incidentally, the World Wide Web as a manifestation of this increased consciousness. And when you think about it, we have an increased consciousness of each other, of the world, and ever. And I should say, I am not doing justice to Teilhard, nor will I do to one other example that I give, because these people wrote brilliant books on this subject. And I will give you a reference that will send you towards that. Another person, and I don't know how many of you know of Polkinghorne. Polkinghorne was a highly accomplished physicist at Cambridge, a devoted Christian. For 25 years, he was a mathematical physicist, made brilliant contributions to particle physics. And then he left science and became a priest, and he's now a bishop, an Anglican bishop. And this is from an interview, and I'll read it just because if you read it, there'll be an uneasy silence. I didn't leave science because I was disillusioned, but I felt I'd done my bit for it after about 25 years. Let me say, first of all, that I admire Teilhard, and one reason I'm quoting this because it kind of flows from what he said. As someone of integrity who sought to hold together his science and his religious experience. But the details of how he did it don't correspond to how I would try to do it myself. I think it's very important to maintain classical Christian distinction between creator and creation. And Teilhard does not. It is all one sort of continuum. Now, essentially, what Polkinghorne did was he described theological concepts, particularly Christian theological concepts, in the language of physics, and specifically quantum physics. So here is just a sort of I wouldn't call it a quote, an extract from of his thinking. He regards, that is Polkinghorne, mind, soul, and body as different aspects of the same underlying reality. dual aspects of monism. There is only one stuff in the world, not two, material and mental. But it occurs in two contrasting states. And you can see, those of you who know quantum mechanics or have, it's the particle wave duality that he has long pages sort of making the analogies. It's all very analogical. Material and mental phases, a physicist might say, which explain our perception of the difference between mind and matter. And again, he wrote several books detailing his sort of construct. And he again also has a following. There are several other prominent thinkers, among them Freeman Dyson, some of you may. He writes very often for the New York Review of Books. Alfred North Whitehead, who developed and believe in cosmic concepts and systems that are often beautiful and compelling, but in essence cannot be tested or proved. So they're outside of the belief. These constructs depend on faith that is tangential to science. Such beliefs do not contradict or interact with science. They are not testable by the methods of science. Incidentally, and this is where I would like to refer to you to the Templeton Foundation. Templeton Foundation sponsors much of this type of constructs. And both Palkinghorn and Dyson were awarded the Foundation Prize, which is pretty hefty. This year, it was $1.42 million, won by a French, again, a person used to be a scientist and moved into sort of philosophical domain, theology merging in sort of theology and philosophy, with a dose of scientific thinking in it, but it's not in any way testable. And this is a quote from him: "I believe we ultimately come from a superior entity to which awe and respect is due, and which we shouldn't try to approach by trying to conceptualize too much. It's more a question of feeling." Well, I would say instead of feeling, faith. Okay, so finally we come to the faith. What then is the faith that drives science? This is from one of the great science fiction movies. On the simplest level, and this is really just very simple, and not what I really would like to want to focus on, as I do. Any project you begin, one has to have faith that it will work. And sometimes it does, and sometimes it doesn't. So for example, 20 years of work by thousands of scientists, literally thousands, has not led to a cure to the AIDS virus or to a vaccine for AIDS. But as I said, that's not what I'm talking about. There is a deeper faith, and again, this is your question, Susanna, that motivated science for the past 200 years, just about from its beginning. The beginning of science is with the beginning of enlightenment, sort of. A faith that there is a unifying principle underlying the diversity of phenomena encountered in nature. And until recently, this kind of a faith that drove this search for this unifying principle has been very successful. One of the earliest successes was the demonstration that the motion of planets is governed by the same laws that govern motion of objects on our planet. Now this quest for unification has hit a stone wall. So let me just go for this look. We're coming to the end. Up until about, and maybe even to the end of science, but you know. Up until about 10 years ago, there was a large measure of confidence, again obtained from measurements and observations, not in any sort of philosophical or theoretical grounds, that there were four forces operant in nature: gravitational force, electromagnetic force, weak force, and strong force. We're all familiar with gravity and electromagnetic forces. The weak and the strong force were necessary postulates to understand how the nucleus stays together, why the positively charged protons don't repel each other. Those are the weak and strong forces. I should point out the weak force is much stronger than these two forces. It's only weak compared to the strong force. Now, the challenge and the belief was that it was possible, was to unify the four forces by finding one set of equations that would govern them all. In other words, that they could be encompassed. Einstein struggled most of his life to unify gravity with electromagnetism, and with no success. It was one of his really great disappointments. Interesting. Having formulated one of the, or two of the most brilliant theories ever put out, the special and general relativity, towards the end of his life, so his biographers who knew him personally, particularly Pius, say he felt like a complete failure. He felt useless and left behind. So, by the 1960s, the electromagnetic, the weak, and the strong forces were unified. One set of equations, rather complex but beautiful equation. Again, it was a theory, and this model, was called the standard model. Notice not law, but model, that unified these three forces. And it's rather complex, but it did it. And there were, again, it was the fruit of thousands of scientists. Well, but here I have, I think, seven of the key people who won Nobel Prizes for their work in this field. Some of the names you may know. Feynman, of course, Schwinger. A lot of them were from Harvard. Schwinger and Glashow and Weinberg was at MIT. Now they're all over the world, and some of them are not with us anymore. But the standard model cannot deal with the gravitational force, just not in it. Again, since 1960, for the past 50 years, thousands of people have been working, squeezing the gravitational force somehow into this construct. No success. One of the most promising things, the string theory, is looking less and less promising. And we can talk a little more about that. Then, 10 years ago, two fascinating complications developed, unrelated one to the other. Better observational techniques allowed the examination in greater detail of the expansion of the universe, the Big Bang. And it was expected, 100%. That what the observation would be that the expansion is slowing down, just like when you throw up a stone, it slows down as it's moving away. And much to everybody's amazement, the initial disbelief, and only 2 years ago, it was shown that the universe isn't slowing down, but it's accelerating. Yeah. And there is some sort of a mysterious anti-gravity force in action. And it's a fascinating story how these discoveries were made. The second discovery, unrelated, that some unknown dark matter permeates the universe. Called dark because we don't observe it. We don't see it, but its effect is unquestionably there. And so the net result is that 96% of the universe is composed of this mysterious dark matter and dark energy. The universe we can observe and know constitutes only 4% of everything. And maybe even less, but so far that's all. It's like that. So now, not only is the gravitational force out of this unified picture, but we have two additional forces whose properties we don't even know really fully. They're completely out as well. So 96% of the universe is composed of mysterious unknown matter. For some, this is a source of intense frustration. But most people working in the fields, actually some that I know, are excited by this new development. And they retain their faith that there is a unifying principle governing the universe. So, thank you for listening.